want to note those carefully. And whether you want to star those or make a separate list of those or whatever, you just want to make sure that you really have, as you've evaluated the facts in Matthew and then evaluated the facts in Mark, you want to be able to really know where the apparent contradictions are, because that's what you have to deal with. You have to be able to deal with those. Now, most people think, oh, no problem. But you know what the most difficult part is in many assignments like this? First of all, it's locating and noting the facts. That's the first problem. The second one is when the facts don't line up. Many people have an extremely hard time just listing that information. So the first two steps are really very, very simple, but you're going to have to read the accounts carefully, very, very carefully. Now, I would advise comparing other translations, because the King James is a little bit hard to follow because of some of the words that are used, some of the ways that they've translated particular Greek words. Now, in the second thing, I would recommend the second step. This is not a required step, but I would recommend that you look at various harmonies of the Gospels. There's one by A.T. Robertson. There's one by a man named Burton. There's about four or five different harmonies of the Gospels. And they might help just to give you an idea as to whether it's one or two different fig trees. I'd also look at Life of Christ books. And these are in the New Testament history section in the library. And you have Foster's book on the life of Christ. There's one by Shepherd. There's also one by Edersheim. And so you want to look up in these Life of Christ books, if you so desire, what they say about this cursing of the fig tree, whether it's one fig tree or whether it's two fig trees. And then you want to look at the commentaries as well. And I would recommend that you do this. And if you do, then try to identify the key points that they use in making an explanation. Don't just, if you give information from these or if you use them, read them thoroughly so that you really can identify key arguments or key explanations. Don't just give me, Foster said it was one fig tree. Edersheim said it was two. That doesn't mean anything to anybody. And who cares what they say as far as that kind of a conclusion? It's why and how they came to the conclusion. And that's what we have to learn to identify. The hows and the whys. What kind of facts? What kind of arguments? So I would recommend looking at these books because they will say quite a bit. And I think they will be helpful. And if you can look in Greek word studies, because there may be some significance in Greek words used. But now, you have to be careful that you don't jump to conclusions with the Greek word studies, because they may say something that they say, this Greek word proves. Well, can you necessarily believe that? Is he the only one that makes this one word prove that it's two different fig trees? Or does another Greek scholar turn around and use that same Greek word to prove that it's one fig tree? So you have to look at that real carefully. You can't jump to conclusions with it. Now, as you're doing all of this, then I want you to begin to formulate your position. And that position would be that there's either one fig tree or there's two fig trees. I dare say that there's not 15. It's really either one or two. Now, if you can get three or four out of it, then you've been doing a lot of reading between the lines. And maybe we need to have a nice heart-to-heart talk with you. I think it'll be one or two. I don't think there'll be too many other fig trees. And it wasn't an apple tree, and it wasn't a pear tree, and there's no partridge in the pear tree, none of that, okay? It has nothing to do with Christmas whatsoever. And Jesus was not just upset at a fig tree, okay? So Jesus likes figs. So don't, if you like figs, don't take this as now Jesus pronouncing them unclean. I hope that none of you will take it this way. Okay, now that you have an answer, I want you to make sure that your answer has answered some of these problems. The first problem is the chronology. The chronology apparently is different. That's why it's so quick to say that it's two accounts. Once you read it, you'll see that there is a problem with chronology. Chronology is like putting something on a timeline, and you have this first, and then this, and then this. Well, if you put Matthew on one timeline and Mark on another, they don't seem to harmonize. There seems to be a real problem. So you have to deal with chronology. You also have to deal with the meaning of a number of words. The first, no heavy sighing when I'm giving this assignment. I feel like I've just put a huge weight upon somebody's back. All of a sudden I heard, whew, and I don't want anybody to have a heart attack or get ulcers from this. So you just relax there, and whoever sighed, no more sighing, whoever that was. If I knew who it was, I would have thrown my briefcase at you, so you're lucky this time. You're just lucky that I don't know who it is. It's like the person who yawns. There have been people that have done that in my classes. I wouldn't mind if it was in Mark Yoker's class or Mike Saban, but my class, big, huge yawn, right down in the front, too. Not somebody hiding behind a book in the back. It's like I heard somebody fell asleep in Ezekiel class the other day. Don's class, about the third row right in front of him. Maybe it was one of you. They had a briefcase on their lap, and they had their arm on the pew in front with a pencil, and they kind of just went like this. And they almost started to snore. And about the person who told me about it said about 7 minutes later, the person just kind of went. Went right back to note-taking. Didn't miss a word. Was that any one of you? Person wouldn't tell me. They didn't want to bring the other one into, you know, a place of disrepute amongst the Bible college teachers. Okay, well, enough of that story. You have to deal with the meaning of presently. The word presently is used in Matthew chapter 21, verse 19. You also have to deal with the phrase, how soon, in Matthew 21, verse 20. It says, it happened presently. And then they said, how soon has it happened? It's not a question, it's an exclamation type of a phrase. And then you have to deal with the phrase, heard it. They heard it. It's referring to they heard him curse the tree. And that's in Mark 11, verse 14. And then you have the phrase, in the morning, referring to time, in the morning, and that's in Mark 11, verse 20. And this next phrase, as far as I'm concerned, I will tell you that I feel that it is the key to the whole thing. But you will have to just... We go from a sigh to a hiccup. And I know who did it. But I won't tell. I don't know if that's worse than maybe a big burp. I wonder which one would be worse. Huh. I think there's a conspiracy to take away from the anointing on this class. I think that's what it is. Oh, it brings to mind another story, but if I tell that, I've lost you for the day, so I won't tell you that story. Okay, the next phrase is, from the roots, and that's in Mark 11, verse 20. So you have the word presently, Matthew 21, 19, how soon, Matthew 21, 20, heard it, Mark 11, 14, in the morning, Mark 11, verse 20, and then from the roots, Mark 11, verse 20. And some of these words don't need that much to be said about them, but... I think they are some of the more significant words and phrases that are used here. And those are the kind of things that you have to identify, and then you have to deal with them. Now, don't take anything for granted. Try to do a full job. But let me say this. What you did on your last assignment, I don't have that corrected, but what I've looked at concerning your work, most of you, well, you really outdid yourselves. I'm glad that you put so much work into it, but you didn't really have to do that much work. The typing was nice, and the title pages are nice, and all of that. But don't necessarily do that. It isn't required. I don't even want you to do it, really, because I want you to center on the assignment and try to really get down to the facts and the problems, and to really trying to put down the answers without worrying about. Is this a perfect sentence or is this a perfect paragraph? I'm more concerned with the key answers and the key explanations, and in that I'm more concerned with the facts that you put into those explanations and that you put into your arguments, so that when I look at it, I can see quickly and clearly where you stand and why you have taken that position. That's what I'm really concerned with. And so I'm going to evaluate what you have come up with in this case, not how pretty it is, or not how nice and neat it is. I'm more concerned with the data. I'm more concerned with the actual research. Now, if you want to put the extra time into it, that's up to you. I'm not going to tell you now, don't type it and don't do these extra things. That's up to you. But if you think that that's going to raise your grade and keep it way above other people, it just won't, because I'm not going to evaluate that and make that as one of the basis for my grading of the paper. If you want to put that extra neatness into it, that's up to you. And I suppose that it's good practice for most of you to do that, but it's not something that I'm going to grade. I'm more concerned with whether or not you get right down to the major problem areas and then how you answer or how you solve those particular problem areas. That's more what I'm concerned with. And make sure, though, that you deal with these points that I've mentioned here. If you don't deal with these points, then I really don't know how you can answer the problems or the discrepancies. These are some of the major problems, these different phrases, these different words that are used. I will tell you that Lenski gives some good information in his commentary. And he deals with a number of the Greek words that are used, and he tries to give you what he feels the meanings of those Greek words are, and he gives you why he feels that they were used there and what they're really saying. And he may be accurate, he may not be accurate, I won't tell you necessarily, but he is a good source to consider. And at least he's dealt with some of the problem areas. And I do not remember what his conclusion is. Now, we'll do the same thing with this assignment that we did with the one that you just turned in. We'll come to class and we'll talk about it. And we'll try to see what you've come up with. But it's due on the 10th of April. Okay, questions? Yes, Doris? The first scriptures? Matthew 21, verses 18 to 22. Mark 11, verses 12 to 14, then verses 19 to 23. Sure. Yes, Sheila? Yeah. That's in between verses 19 to 23 in Mark 11. See, Mark 11, verses 12 to 14, and then verses 19 to 23. Yeah, it'd be pretty hard. There's only 16 chapters in Mark. So. I remember that. It's pretty good, huh? That's why I teach. I can remember all those important facts. It's not that important. Other questions? As you all sit there amazed at my conversation between myself. Just talking to myself. That's all I was doing. And yet, yes, Doris. Oh, I know. That's what it seemed like. One person found out this person had 4 pages, so I'm going to have 6. This person heard that this person had 6, so I'm going to have 12. This person had 12, so they're going to have 24. This person typed, so I'm going to have an expert typist secretary at some famous school type it for me. That seems to be what happened. It kind of, somebody got the old snowball rolling, and it really rolled right through the class. That appears, and they put a cover on, and I'm going to put, their cover costs 15 cents, mine's going to cost 30 cents. That appeared to be what happened. But just do your assignment and don't worry about what other people are doing. But that's fine. I would have probably done the same thing. I would have been swept up in the same mania that everyone else was. I don't know what the word mania means. I just used it. It's probably a good word, right? Okay, any other questions? Now, if you type your other assignment, don't worry about it. You know, if you type this one, that's fine. But I just don't want you to concentrate on all of that and miss really doing the assignment. That's my major point. And I also heard how many people were in the library the Sunday night before it was due, and how many were probably there the Monday night after it was due, and how many were just in absolute fear that they just had not done a very good job. And so don't worry about that. Just do the best that you can with the time that you have. If you turn it in late, that's fine. I don't take a late paper and light a match and watch it burn up. I do grade late papers, and I don't usually take that much off because I want you to get it in, and I don't want to discourage some of you that do have heavy schedules so that you get it in late and then it goes from an A to a D minus. Well, there's not much sense and doing a lot of work, if it's late one day and it goes from an A down to a D, that wouldn't be too much motivation to try to get it in. I want you to get the assignments in and just do the best that you can with them. That's my main concern. And the assignments help you to begin to understand what research is all about. And I can talk about it until I'm blue in the face, and you still don't really understand it. And the way that the problem is kind of this. What happened in this class is that I used to give more assignments. And if I teach the class next year, I will give many more assignments. Because I have come to the firm conclusion that no matter what anybody says, the only way to teach this class is with quite a few assignments. And the first semester, in my opinion, was not near as good as it could have been. I did not do a very good job with it because we spent too much time on what I now feel is just a lot of trivia. And now we don't have much time, and so I'm having to give you more assignments, and so it's probably making it a little bit burdensome. But I do want you to get something out of the class, and I've just come to realize that the only way that you can actually learn is if I give you assignments. You got more out of the JL assignment than probably anything else we did in the first semester. And that's because you had to get in and do something. You had to think, you had to evaluate, you had to use some books, and you had to come to conclusions, and that's what you need to have to be forced to do. And the policy in the Bible College has been to cut way back on assignments because we wanted to get more people in Bible College because there was a financial problem, and a lot of people are only taking part-time because they're so afraid of assignments. Well, then that's had an impact on quite a few of the different classes, and unfortunately, I just took that and went too far with it, and so this class hasn't really been as valuable, and as far as my conclusion, as valuable this time as it has been previously. But so it's kind of an unfortunate thing. But the assignments are really calculated. They're not busy work at all. They're interesting, and there's some really good things that you can learn from it. And one of the things that you really learn is where you spend too much time. And this is a thing that takes a long time to really be experienced with. It is so easy to identify trivial areas and study those for hours and find out that really doesn't mean anything one way or the other. And I will have one last assignment after this one. There won't be any final in this class or anything like that. You just have the report making and then these three assignments, and I'll give you right up to probably the last day of class or something to get the last assignment in. It's not as difficult, I don't think, as this one. But that is a really good assignment as far as where people will spend all kinds of time with trivia and miss the main point. And I'll give you some warnings so you won't necessarily do that. But without the actual experience and without actually making mistakes in research, you won't learn these things. Just like I went through that list of the common hindrances, and I told you some of those things, and you get it down in notes, but it means nothing to you. Because most of you have not done enough research that when you write down that point, you go, yeah, I did that on that assignment and that assignment and that assignment. No wonder it was such a wasted effort. You see, you don't have much experience behind you so that when you put down a list of mistakes, that you can really even identify with the mistakes. That's another reason why I suppose it would be better if people who had been here for a year or two would take this class. But yet at the same time, if new students can come right in and really listen and really make some decisions about this material, then it will help them immensely through their other years of Bible College. But it is very, very hard for people to come into a class where you're dealing with things that they have really never had anything to do with it, and now they're being given all this information of how to research and things to look for and things not to do and how comes and whys and wherefores. It's very, very hard to take that information and really allow it to do much in your heart at all unless you have some past experience to base it on. It's just very hard to do. Now, some of you are doing an excellent job, but I know that some of the things that I talk about, they go in one ear and out the other, and they go passing over some of your heads. But for the most part, I think that you've benefited quite a bit, and I think that you would benefit more if you had more past experience in which to calculate this information on and to base it on, but it's about all we can do is just hope that it gets across and that it makes a good overall impact. Mm-hmm. Brenda.
How much time do you estimate
should it fit on the last slide? I would say that you're not going to be able to spend under 10 hours on it. Yeah. I would imagine that most people probably spend anywhere between, say, 15 and 20 hours. Well, I don't want to include typing because it really shouldn't have been typed. But if you typed it, it may be two or three more hours added on to that. Unless you're, if you're an excellent typer, it may have only taken 45 minutes or half an hour. If you're a run-of-the-mill typist, it could have taken a week working 24 hours a day. And then it would have probably still been 4 days late. So, but I would just say offhand, maybe about 10 hours. But it's very difficult to really give an actual time that it would take. Some people, they will do an excellent job, but it takes them 30 hours. And they at this point, cannot work any faster. And maybe 4 years from now, they still can't work any faster. They have to go kind of, and don't take this wrong, but they have to kind of plod through it. That's just the way they have to, and that's just what that's their capability, and that's fine. I am not, in my opinion, that fast of a researcher. It takes me quite a bit of time to go through things, but I don't mind taking the time. So I don't really consider time. I just consider more the assignment and what has to be done in order to complete the assignment. But I would say that probably 10 hours to 15 hours would have probably sufficed. But the thing that really is difficult is that if you say, okay, it's 10 hours, and I'll sit down for 10 different days or 10 different sittings and just 1 hour each, you'll find that you won't get much done. If you can do it in blocks of time of, say, really at no less than, say, 2.5 hours to 3 or 4 hours at least, where you sit down and you just study for, say, 2.5 straight hours, that 2.5 hours is far more profitable than sitting down one afternoon for an hour, the next afternoon for an hour, and the next afternoon for half an hour. You virtually get nothing done in those three sittings as compared to that one block of time where you studied 2.5 straight hours. See, it's just the way that it is. It takes time to really get involved again in the assignment. And if you're trying to get involved in it through many different sittings, you're not going to get much done. You may put in far more hours than the other person, but let's say they sat down in 3-4 hour blocks of time, and those 3-4 hour blocks of time are going to be much better than, say, 21 hour or 21.5 hour sessions or 21.5 hour sessions. The larger blocks of time, you will find that you will be able to accomplish more. And that's just generally the way it is. Now, it won't be necessarily true for every single person. But you should try to give yourself blocks of time where you do not take phone calls, where you do not get snacks, where you do not let people come into the room and talk to you, where you just... Now, obviously, it's not always that easy. But I would recommend the old phone off the hook and in the drawer and the sign on the door saying, "Leave me alone. Don't even think of coming into this room." Locking it, bolding it, putting a minefield out in front of it, and really study. Now, other times, it's difficult, but that's the kind of an attitude. Now, the library is not, I hate to say it, but it's not a good place to study. The library is a miserable place to study because everybody comes in and gabs. And they come in and they see, "How have you been doing?" "Shut up! I'm doing horrible! Because of people like you!" I mean, that's what you'd like to say. But you've just gone over and visited 12 other people and they'd like to strangle you or put you in the garbage can. So, kind of works both ways. The library is just not a very good place. It is harder to work in there. You have to get all your books, the books that you want to use, and take them to your table and trying to sit there for at least an hour with those books without, "Oh, now I need this book. And go getting that one. Oh, I need this book and go getting that one." You need to try to think far enough ahead so that you bring enough material to the desk. Now, they say, what do they say? You can only have, if you're not using the book, you can't have it at your table. There's got to be a spirit to that law, because otherwise you're not going to get anything done. You have to get enough material to your desk so you can work there for at least an hour straight so that you can just sit there and really think about it and really get something done. Otherwise, you just won't get anything done. If you're getting up every 15 minutes to go get another book, you're going to waste, in 1 hour, you're going to waste at least 20 minutes. I guarantee it. and you're wasting time having to get up and then go get in the book, and you're going to probably end up talking to somebody. And then when you get back down to your table, you're probably thinking about, well, I should ask her for a date, and, well, maybe I could go sit closer to her, or, you know, all of this kind of, I can't use the word nonsense, but, well, I guess I can. All that nonsense is going on, so you're just not getting anything done. So when you go to study, you have to really make a decision that you're going to study. If you're going to go pray, you have to make a decision you're going to go pray. If you're going to go witness, you have to go witness. So whatever you have to do, make sure that you really do it and give yourself the time to do it. But if you try to just do it in small little blocks of time, 1 hour here, 45 minutes here, it is not very successful. And you will not get much out of that time of study unless you're just an exceptionally good student. And there aren't too many that really fit into that category. It's real hard to be disciplined with that amount of time. It's just the mind likes to keep thinking about all kinds of other things and involved in all kinds of other issues, and then it's really easy to go find a magazine in the library and just kind of thumb through that, or you notice another book on the shelf that you decide to thumb through, and you're just not going to get much done. But if you get the books and sit down and really decide to study, then you can get a lot done. You'll find if you give yourself larger blocks of time in which to study, you'll do generally much better, and your time will be much more effective.
Yeah. Consult the library for your source, you know, but you don't want to spend the time there. What I did, go and decide what commentaries you're going to use, mm-hmm. for what books, and spend a dollar in dimes and go ahead and burn copies of them, and then take, you know, put them back on the shelf and then leave and go home. Put your form.
Yeah, that is a good suggestion. Sometimes a dollar might not be something that you possess. You may have to rob your neighbor. But that is a good idea, and I would recommend that as well. There are times that it's much better if you know that, say, four commentaries contain the information that you need. Sometimes it's better to just get those copied and get the information in your, now it's your own possession, and take it home, or, you know, especially if at home it's a better place to study. The problem is that some dorms or some other places where people have to study are worse than the library, so you have to find out which is best out of whatever you have to choose from. You have 14 evils to choose from, so you just have to find the lesser of all those evils and then take that place and make that more or less your place where you're going to study. It's nice to go to the library with your girlfriend and all of that, but, boy, you really have to make a decision that if you're going to go there, you have to study, because it's so easy to look up and, oh, she's so pretty, and I need to stare for a while. Oh, you have to write her a note now. Oh, I love you. Big kissy on there. Give it to her. Oh. If I was her, I'd take my Adam Clark commentary, and that would end the relationship, of course, but you'd get something done. No, if you're going to study, study. I think that most of you are beginning to realize that in most assignments, there are hours of wasted time. And you say that something, this assignment, I worked every day for 4 weeks to get it done. But if most people would be honest with what they did during that, you know, protracted length of time, they didn't really work all that time. So there are a number of things you can do. You can get the copies and take the material home and study it at home, or bring the books to your desk. But the main thing is that if you want to make excuses so that you don't study, it doesn't matter where you are. You can make excuses with anything. You can find ways out of studying that are, well, they're magical. They're beyond description, the way that we can rationalize our way out of actually having to sit down and study. The main thing is that when you go to study, you really study. That is the main thing. And but I suppose, getting back to the assignment, that anywhere between 10 and 15 hours of real work. Now, see, sometimes a person is not a very good reader, and so they have to put more time into just reading through commentaries. Other people are very quick readers, so they don't have to spend as much time. So there are those kind of considerations as well. But generally, probably about 10 to 15 hours, I would say. And I would say that the same thing is true here. In this case, going through the commentaries and these other references will not be fruitless. whereas in your other assignment it was the commentaries were not very helpful. Some did address the problem slightly, but that's about all. And that is an important thing to learn. So there's all kinds of things that we need to learn in doing our research. Some of you will be more dependent upon books in your research for sermons, Sunday school lessons, and things of that nature in the future, and there won't be anything wrong with that, than other people. Some of you won't be as dependent. The books, each one will have to use them the way that they feel best in using them. Some will want to use books more than other people. Now, when Don does his research, he goes through most every commentary, and he'll look at almost every single one. But other people would not necessarily do that. So it just depends on the individual and what they feel can be found in various reference works. And so it's pretty much your own individual type of a commitment. That's why I said that I would recommend that you go through some of these books, but it's not absolutely required. I do feel that in this case you would find the books to be more profitable by 1,000% increase than what we had with the last assignment. Gary? Mm-hmm. Well, in the last assignment, I think the best thing that could have been done is to try to go through and just prove it by using the King James, maybe New American Standard, Rotherham, and say the Kingdom Interlinear, and just see what you could find on your own by reading chapters 1, chapter 2, and then any other parallel passages that would have any sort of a bearing on the immediate question. I think that would have been the best first step. And I think that most of you would have been able to come up with a number of solid proofs as to whether it's the 12 or the 120. I think most everyone would have been able to do that. Now, some would have more difficulty with that than others because in some cases it's very difficult to really know what constitutes proof. Now, see, many times we will use things and say this is proof, but it's not proof. And somebody will be able to whisk that right away. In other cases, you'll have tons of proof, and they'll still whisk it away because their heart is just not going to receive it. But I would have gone through those passages first, and then after that, I would take the time to go through 15, 20 commentaries just to see if they add anything or they bring up some questions that I haven't answered or haven't considered that might be helpful to the entire question. Because many times they will do that, and it can be extremely helpful. And they might bring up something that you didn't think of, and it's another good, substantial proof. So I think it is always good to use the books to one degree or another. That's my feeling on it. I think you can get a lot out of them. But you have to learn that in some cases, it's best, first of all, just to use the Word and other translations and literal-type reference works where they're not giving you their own theology, or they're just giving you data, they're giving you information, and then you can make your own evaluation of that information. But then after doing that, I think it is good to consult the books to see if they can add or they can introduce other points or other issues or other questions that might make your study even more fruitful, or it might make it more diversified, it might cover more of the different perspectives, more of the different aspects, so that it would be more conclusive, so that more people would be satisfied with your proof than just say one little narrow group that said, well, all we need is this one proof or these two proofs, but you might be able to answer it from a number of different points of view, and so in total it would be a much better study. So I think that's just kind of a good habit to have, to start primarily in the Word itself, because that has to be our basis, and then after we've done that as fully as we possibly can, then go to the other references and see if they can add any information that would be helpful. I think it's a good habit, it's a good practice. Craig, did you have a question or comment? No, what is it, Craig? Proverbs 25:17. This better be good, Craig. Proverbs 25:17. This is our revelation for the day. One hath a doctrine, another hath a tongue, and then Craig has the revelation today. 25:17. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee, and so hate thee. Okay, Craig, we'll accept that one. That's a good one. Proverbs 25:17. Yep. That could be the person at the table next to you. That could be the person in the room next to yours. It covers quite a few different people. And it... Yes, this would be a very good sign to put on your door. Also, anything to do with the lake of fire, eternal judgment, anything like that, that would be... If you can find any synonyms to the word hate, that would be good too. Anything real powerful. Yes, sir?
One of the things that I suggest that people can do at the same time, seems like it spends a lot of time in the warm-up and saves a lot of time, pick up a reference book. Number one, if you never use the reference book, read the directions on how to use the amazing how much time people spend shooting something and not knowing what they're looking at. And secondly, even if you have used that reference book 100 times, spend a couple of minutes just briefly
going through
the instructions of how to use that film. A lot of people, for example, pick up a rocker hand and they will have never read the introduction of a rocker hand and they miss an opportunity to get a lot out of it.
And the lines and brackets, they mean nothing to most people. They just added a little artwork to the translation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, try to really have a concept in your mind as to what the purpose of that work is. Sometimes you can be upset with a book in the way that, well, it didn't have any information, and then you can put a wrong evaluation on the book, but the book was not to be used the way that you've been using it, and so you miss the entire purpose of the book. Now, once you understand what the book is really for, you might find that it has some very, very valuable points of information. So it's good to read the introduction and the preface and to look through. In many books, they'll have, in the appendix section, they'll have a lot of information there dealing with all kinds of different things. It is just good to see overall what a book contains. So that's a real good practice. But most people do not do that. Very few people read the introduction. Very few people read anything about the author. That can also be very helpful, because you can find out if he's a Calvinist, you can find out if he's a Pentecostal, you can find out a lot of things about him. And it can be helpful as far as you being able to better understand the point of view this person is writing from. And another thing that happens is that you can get very discouraged at what the author has written, but until you really understand the author and his purpose, again, you're misusing the book. Once you understand who the person is and what he was really trying to accomplish, then many times you'll see that the book has value. Most every reference book in our library, as far as I'm concerned, has quite a bit of value. But it's learning what's in them and how to use them. And so that's another important part of research. Yes, Rob?
I understand that soon there was to be another class on how to use the Thompson Chain Reference Bible sometime soon. So that someone was going to...
I think that was in the bulletin or something.
Yeah.
There's a tape on it that you can check out from the office. Don did a presentation on it. I don't know if he was going to give this one. Did it say he was? Okay, he's going to squeeze it in right between the dating and the marriage. It's a real important part of dating. Can make or break a marriage. You don't believe that, do you? But there is a tape available in the office, as far as I know. There was before. Somebody might have stolen it and sold it on the black market. A lot of seminaries have been trying to get a hold of that tape. We'll read Proverbs 25:17 again. Probably not. We'll just go on. Any other questions? This is fun day in Methods of Bible Research. Okay, well, we've been talking about how to research. We were mentioning some mistakes that occur in actual methods of interpretation: dogmatic interpretation, rationalistic interpretation, allegorical interpretation by encyclopedias, interpretation by revelation. And I don't know if I mentioned the last one, scholastic interpretation. I did, huh? Okay, well, I won't mention that one in. But I will point out one thing. I said it before, but I will say it again. When you're in this thing of scholastic interpretation, in just using books or quotations or ideas from other individuals to produce your theology or to produce the answers to the various questions that you might have, you're obviously going to be in a dangerous place. But one thing that people do is they like to use, like, Webster's Dictionary, and they like to define reconciliation by Webster's Dictionary. They like to define judgment by Webster's Dictionary. They like to define other biblical terms by Webster's Dictionary or Random House Dictionary. Those dictionaries are not to be used in doing that. Now, if you want to look in Webster's Dictionary just to see what he gives as his concept of reconciliation, well, that's fine. But you have to go to references that will give you the biblical meaning of the word. The secular meaning might be entirely different than the biblical meaning. And you can't rely on Webster's to give you a proper definition of biblical terms. What do you think Webster's going to say about the Trinity? Well, he's going to give you what he thinks is a biblical explanation. But it's not going to be a correct one. It's going to be inaccurate. So he'll do that with other things as well. So you just have to be careful. You have to evaluate your question or your problem and then make sure that you use the right kind of references to answer the problem or to answer the question or to solve it. You cannot be using secular sources. You also have to be careful with, like, the Encyclopedia Britannica and World Book and all of those. You have to be careful in how you use those as well. Sometimes you can use those to get an accurate picture of church history because they'll give you information on various different moves of God and different groups of God that have existed throughout the New Testament church. But you cannot put much weight on what they say. Now, you can put it in as a secondary source of information or something, but you surely can't put much weight on it. You have to be very, very careful. And just as another point of interest, and this is important to good research, let's say you open up a commentary and it gives you a quote from some church father or some other historian. Do not necessarily believe that the quote has been represented properly. Do you know how many quotes can be taken out of context that when you read the quote, it seems to be saying exactly the opposite of what it really said in the first place? It happens all the time. It happens in newspapers. It happens in magazines. It happens in Bible reference works as well. You just have to be careful. They can say, this man of God prophesied. What is their definition of prophecy? It is not necessarily what the biblical definition of prophecy is. Many people teach that prophecy is preaching. So when they say, this person way back in 200 AD prophesied, that may not mean that at all. What you would have to do is go back and find that actual first-hand source and read it yourself. And another thing that happens, these sources were written in Latin, in Greek, in German, a number of other languages, and so they've been translated. The translations have not always been accurate either. So you cannot put much weight in all of these quotes from past historians or things that happened in church history. You have to be very, very careful. And that includes our church history class here in this Bible college. Some of the things that are brought forth, it's just you have to sift out all kinds of information and just try to come to the best understanding available at that point in time. That's all you can do. But you cannot necessarily know whether or not, say, this person was had this one particular bend theologically or this one had this bend. You have to just kind of take the whole thing with a grain of salt. But see, our theology is not based on church history. Our theology is not based on quotations from church fathers. Our theology is in this book. Our guideline to walk with God is in this book. And if nobody from the beginning of the church knew anything about the rapture, so what? It means nothing. They didn't know anything about proper water baptism. It means nothing. If they didn't know what it meant to be Spirit-filled, it means nothing. It's what this book says today. This is all that counts. What the church has done before counts nothing, in a sense. Now, you can add some qualification to that, and that's fine. You can learn a number of different things from the church, but if you don't look at it properly, you begin to say, well, the majority dictates what is right. That means we're all going to be Roman Catholics. That's the way it is. Now, whether you realize it or not, our democratic system is part of a brainwash that the devil has used on all kinds of religious people to keep them locked up in false doctrine. Because there is a concept that the majority is always right and the minority is wrong. That's a concept that most every person has. Now, they won't admit to it right offhand, but they have that concept because that's what they are dictated to as far as our whole system. You vote on this president and the majority wins, and so that man becomes president. And so the majority had to be right that this was the best man. How many times do you think the best man has really been in office? How many times do you think the people even had the opportunity to vote for the best man? I would imagine that if God could have told you who is the best man available in every single election, I would just say that we have never had an opportunity to vote for the best man. That's what I would say, just generally speaking. I would almost say that that's probably absolute fact, that we've never had opportunity throughout all the history of the presidential elections to vote for the best man available for the job. Think I'm right? It's a good possibility. But man says, no, we've always had the opportunity, and the majority has always chosen the best one. But it just isn't the case. So we have to be very, very careful how we take information and what we do with it, how we evaluate quotations, because it is very easy to get a quotation that is actually misrepresentative of what the person was saying. And there's quite a few examples of that. And we're doing it right now and going through glossolalia as far as all the historical information in glossolalia about the different people that have spoken in tongues. There's a lot of information for people speaking in tongues throughout the history of the New Testament church. But some of the people that you would really want to have spoken in tongues, maybe they never did. But let me put it this way. If John Wesley didn't speak in tongues, what does that mean to you? Are you going to stop speaking in tongues? What if Martin Luther didn't speak in tongues? Are you going to stop speaking in tongues? What if Finney didn't speak in tongues? What if Moody didn't speak in tongues? Now see, many of those might have, and some probably did. But we may never know absolutely one way or the other. But that doesn't mean anything, because you are basing your theology in the Word of God. Now those are good examples, because a lot of people are simply looking back in history, trying to find a mold or a pattern to follow, and they're trying to attach themselves to some sort of a train of thought. They're trying to make sure that they fit in with, the majority, but that isn't the way to find out what the truth is. And that's not the way to find out how to walk with God. That's the way to get locked up in deception, and that's the way to end up in a number of ditches and to miss the real beaten track that Jesus himself walked upon. So we just have to be careful. We have to be careful how we evaluate things that we find in books. So if you just take it scholastically, if it's in a book, it must be right because somebody wrote it down. That doesn't make it right. The newspapers prove that. The magazines prove that. All kinds of Bible references prove that. And it doesn't matter whether the man was a good man or a bad man. If he doesn't have a right concept as to what he's really doing, he can write some wrong things, even if he has a good heart. So everything that we read, we have to really evaluate. That's why it's so dangerous just to be kind of in a place where you just let all kinds of things come in your mind, and it's not good. This is off the subject totally. But some people just turn on a Christian radio station and they just kind of leave it on at home because it has some good music, it has some horrible music, it has some good theology, and it has horrible theology as well. And they just let that go on all day long. That is not good. It's not healthy. Because your mind, it is registering in your mind subconsciously when you don't even know that it's registering. And all of a sudden you're finding out that you're not really being very critical as to what is good and as to what is bad. You're not making any judgments, any evaluations, and in the long run, it's very detrimental. Okay. I'll just remember, I don't have my... Ben mark them off in red. So I'll try to remember to mark them off next time. Oh, there we go. There's a red pen. That's good. Thank you, Sheila. Okay, just try to get it done. Just try to get it done as soon as you can. Sure.
One of the things you use the dictionary for, the normal one that I found, only when you're reading the Bible, if you've got a good dictionary, and you're reading a King James or reading an old commentary, and you come across a word that seems to be backwards or something.